Before we start, we're running a great premium offer on Unknown Country this week. If you go to unknowncountry.com and subscribe for 1 year or for 6 months, you will get free a copy of The Afterlife Revolution for your Kindle. The gift will be sent to you through Amazon, and you can easily get the book right on your Kindle. So take advantage of this offer this week. It ends next Thursday, January 25. Get The Afterlife Revolution. Great reviews, an extraordinary book that I think you need to read because it's going to change the way you think about yourself in this life and beyond. And subscribing to Unknown Country, you can't go wrong. If you prefer your subscription to run for only 1 year or 6 months, just write subscribers at unknowncountry.com and they will set it to non-renewing. The initial period is not refundable because of the premium. So go subscribe today and you'll get The Afterlife Revolution to read, and it is worth it. This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world. Today, we're going to be talking about the ongoing mystery of the world with one of the great philosophical and scientific minds of our time. Free Dreamlanders, you'll be enjoying this important program uninterrupted by commercials and in full. Please subscribe to unknowncountry.com. Erwin Laszlo is with us. I have struggled quite a long time to get this to work. For some reason, all sorts of things intervened. He is a philosopher and systems scientist. He's been twice nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. He has published more than 75 books and over 400 articles and research papers. The subject of the one-hour PBS special, Life of a Modern-Day Genius, Laszlo is the founder and president of the international think tank, the Club of Budapest, and of the prestigious Laszlo Institute of New Paradigm Research. He is also talking to us from Italy and is the winner of the 2017 Luxembourg Peace Prize. Welcome to Dreamland.
Thank you very much, Italy. I look forward to chatting with you.
Yes, me too. I want to start in, you know, there's a wonderful introduction. Erwin's book is The Intelligence of the Cosmos, and it asks the critical question, why are we here? And what is so important about this book is that we are getting to the point in science and in the philosophy of science that we can actually explore real answers to that question for the first time. A very extraordinary and very exciting time in which to be alive, and that's why the subtitle is New Answers from the Frontiers of Science. Now, Jane Goodall wrote the foreword for the book, which is itself worth the price of the entire book. It's fabulous. She says, Laszlo points out that mainstream science has not grasped the real significance of the complexity of the laws and the phenomena of nature. Now, Erwin, that to me is an absolutely critical statement. And I wonder if you could speak to how you respond to that now and where you are in terms of moving ahead.
Well, as long as one lives, one learns. One has to learn.
Hello,
can you hear me? I'm saying
anyone
as
there?
Long as, yes, I'm here.
Oh,
hello.
Phooey.
Why don't you try calling me? I can respond. I'll respond right away and maybe it'll work better.
Oh, I'm sorry, Erwin. Okay, why don't you start again and then I can erase that. I don't know. It cut out the sound for a minute.
Oh, okay. Well, as long as one lives, one learns. One always has to be open to new ideas. So I'm trying to find out who I am. That's something I think most people take for granted. But now, as you say, more and more scientists even are coming up with the question, who are we? How can we situate the human being in this complex architecture of life on Earth and possibly also life elsewhere in the universe? Do we have a purpose for being here? Is there a meaning to our life? These are questions that have been asked for thousands of years. And now I think there are findings, observations coming from the frontiers of science that shed a more trustworthy light on the conditions for which, under which we can answer such great, great, forever perennial questions. So before getting into the details, I'm sure you'll be asking questions about this. Let me just say that I believe that what science is telling us now is radically new and imperceptibly, but very really old. It's a discovery, and it's also a rediscovery. What we are beginning to know today are the same, almost the same things in a different form, in different language, what people have been saying for hundreds, if not for thousands of years, leading seers, leading prophets, leading sensitive people, artists, even now scientists. So it's a remarkable time when science is catching up with the old wisdom, traditional wisdom, and new science are finding common ground. And on this common ground, we have to recognize who we are and why we are here.
This gets me to the idea of informed vibrations, David Bohm's concept, and its relationship that you discuss to the Sanskrit concept of akasha. Could you speak to that?
Well, it's a tremendous discovery, or rediscovery, as I just said, that when you get right down to the deepest, plumbing the depths, so to speak, of the universe. Hello?
Yes, we're still here. Keep going.
Oh, okay. When we get down to the deepest depths of the universe, then we find things that are not material. Nothing is material. And since all things that are on higher levels and more evident levels are ultimately made of things that are on this basic level, I think we have a good reason to say that there are no strictly material things in the universe. You mentioned informed vibration. Let me just say a few words about that. Those final, ultimate little particles that are known as the quantum particles, they are not pieces of matter. They are not something that's hard, that is given there. It is something which is like a signal in a large network. It is something that exists in virtue of it having a specific frequency and volume and phase and amplitude. These are characteristics of all wave phenomena. And when you say that very likely all things in the world are kind of waves, wave phenomena, then it's true, but we also have to add that, as you say, these waves exist in a matrix, which is a vibrational matrix. The whole universe is vibrating. And these vibrations appear to have started with the Big Bang 13.8 billion years ago. At that point, this tremendous cosmic flash explosion, it's a singularity, as scientists call it, has brought what was hitherto a quiet, probably a constant, maybe perhaps an eternal, smooth background, which was a potential for all things. Even the Bible talks us in very similar terms, in different terms, but the similar ideas of there being the Spirit of God, which was flashing or skating over the waters. That was, everything was quiet, and then it brought into motion. What brought it into motion now is this cosmic singularity, which we call the Big Bang. And yes, since then, the universe has been vibrating, and all things in it are vibrations. And they are very particular vibrations. They are coherent vibrations. They are vibrations. Many of them are in phase. they work together, and they create phenomena.
And when you say in phase, what precisely does that mean?
Well, you can distinguish waves in terms of their phase, the amplitude, and the frequency. Phase means that these vibrations, when they get going, if they get going at the same time, then they constantly move together up and down, up and down, but they move what we call in phase, they move together. That means that they reinforce each other. If you have a wave and comes another wave, and if it's in phase, if it comes at the same time, it becomes a bigger wave. If it comes when the wave has just passed, if it comes in the trough, then one wave cancels another. If you stand at the edge of the sea, of the beach, of the sea, and you see how these waves flash and move on to the shore, then you can observe this phenomenon. Every once in a while, a wave comes exactly when a previous wave has come, and then it becomes a bigger wave. If it comes when the previous wave has just passed, then it becomes a smaller wave, smaller than before. They work at cross purposes, as it were. So the phenomenon that we can identify as real, as being part of the observable part of this universe, which are entities, which are kind of things, but as I said, not material things. These are in-phase waves, and they are waves that are coherent, that create together things that appear to us, when we perceive them, appear to us as a solid entity, which we have considered to be a material entity. But we ourselves are such in-phase waves, clusters of waves in the universe, and therefore we perceive the others when they are likewise similarly coherent in-phase clusters of waves. So it's a different picture, not so unusual, not so surprising in a world where information is a major element, where energy is beyond all other things, the foundation of things, and where signals, information based on signals, is how everything communicates with and relates to everything else. So in the new world, in the wired world of the internet, of communications, the concept of the universe as a series of in-phase waves, significant waves that join together and jointly interact with other things, that's not so surprising.
And they interact with and change the as they interact, they change the speed or the intensity of the vibration. Is that correct?
Of course, yes. The interaction means nothing. It remains the way it was. They either reinforce each other, or they cancel each other, or weaken each other. And so there are interactions where change, where everything is changed. Then when a thing interacts with another thing, whatever that thing is, whether it's a vibration or something else, it interacts, it means effectively changes. Nothing remains the same as it was when it gets in contact, when it communicates with something else. So we can deduce the ancient insight. Everything is connected with everything else. And we can also add to that insight that when the connection is established, everything changes, everything else, including itself. Communication means change. Change ultimately means evolution, progressive change. Many things disappear, devolve, but on the majority of the cases, this universe, the way it is now, is because in the long term, in the 13.8 billion years since the Big Bang, more of it has evolved and structured each other, itself, together with the others, than would have canceled each other. On the whole, this is an evolving, coherent, communicating universe, and we are a part of it.
In the book, one of the essayists, John Audette, refers to the questions of who we are and why we are here as gateway questions, because they can lead to breakthrough discoveries and life-changing epiphanies. I thought that was very well put. And I want to go start with the question of not so much of who we are, which we will get to, but the question first of why are we here? It is, as you say in the book, probably the most challenging question ever asked. And now I'm asking you, and if you hang up on me, I won't be surprised.
Well, I've written a book on it. I should be prepared to answer it.
Yes, that's right. And of all the people whose books I've ever read in recent times, I think you are indeed prepared to answer it. I wouldn't have ever asked it.
Well, we have to go back a little bit. Is there a reason why we can believe that we have an answer? Is there a reason for the answer? I think there is. And let's start with this fact, or this observation. It's almost an abstract fact. When you have a chaotic system, then anything can happen at any time. When everything is fortuitous, when everything is accidental, then you can't answer the question, why is anything the way it is? The only answer you can possibly give is because it so happened. It's just a fortune. Just a fortunate thing that it turned out this way. It could have turned out some other way. And it's constantly changing. And it has no rhyme or reason. It's all serendipity. Now, if you take this premise, which was very popular in science, even a decade ago, even a few years ago, mainstream scientists in many schools are still teaching that the universe, evolution of the universe, is just a series of random interactions. In physics classes, this is sort of an introductory statement. But at the leading edge, you discover something else. To explain why things are the way they are, why anything is there which is coherent, which is observable, which appears to be an entity, something that has form and that has a life of some kind of its own. To create such an entity, you would have to have an incredible amount, an astronomical amount of interactions before you have a reasonable probability that such an entity could be produced. Now, you know, to give an example, the so-called Rubik's Cube, this cube that has six faces like our cubes, but it, on each face it has six colors, and it can all be turned, scrambled, and then unscrambled. It's been calculated that if you get this Rubik's Cube in a scrambled way, which randomly put together all the faces facing each other just in a randomly ordered way, and if you want to be sure that you have completely ordered all six faces and all the colors and all the faces, and if you take 1 second for each of the turns that you give to this cube, then how long do you think it would take? Well, the mathematical calculation shows something like when 1 on the 23 powers of seconds, which doesn't sound like much, but it is actually longer than the age of the universe. There are that many combinations, even in a simple Rubik's Cube. Now, if you take a living entity, if you take anything more complex than just the simpler things, then the probability that would come about through random interactions is so minimal, it's negligible. It's most likely it would never do so. Fred Hoyle, the mathematical physicist, has said that the probability that a random change in the DNA of a species would produce a living species, another species, the probability is similar to that of a hurricane blowing through a scrapyard producing a working aeroplane. That means that there is a probability, but it's so small as to be completely negligible. So this universe, what are the conclusions then? This universe, this world that we inhabit, ourselves included, is astronomically unlikely to have come about through random interactions. There is something like an order, a logic. If there was a living entity behind this, there's a higher order entity, then we could talk about the purpose. And this is always a possibility. What we can observe and conclude from our observations is that this is not a chance-ridden universe. Everything is connected with everything else that we know now from quantum physics. And we also find out now from these considerations that everything is connected in a perfectly reasonable, reasoned, and coherent way. Not a new observation, by the way. Einstein, among others, other physicists, said that the most remarkable fact about this universe is that it's coherent, that it's describable, that we can measure it, that we can count with it. This is an ordered universe. We are a part of it. And therefore, the question of why we are here has at least a basis for answer. This basis is we are here because whatever orders the chaos that was first the reality of this universe after the Big Bang, and it began to order itself since then, ever since then, that chaos has an inner logic, a higher logic. It moves someplace. It moves in a direction. And this direction, at the most basic level, the simplest level, doing away with all the complexities, appears to be toward increasing coherence. Things are more and more coherently related to other things. Now, let me just add here just one definition. By coherence, I simply mean not a complex form of it, because there are all kinds of definitions, but the simplest description of coherence is it's a system in which every part is related to every other part in such a way that what happens to one also is felt, it happens in some way by all the others. Then the system is coherent. Now it appears that the direction of change in the universe, including the physical universe, including the biological universe, then the cognitive, conscious universe, all its elements, all its forms, whenever there is a process, some of it disappears in incoherence, yes. Some of it breaks down. But on the whole, the process builds up rather than goes down. And we are the result of this build-up on this planet, build-up of coherence. Because in our body, every single cell is connected with every other cell. And they all together work to maintain our body in life. Because just imagine, if any part of this system, of this organism, would not be in contact, coherently in contact with every other part, it would become a disease. And disease, in fact, can be defined as the incoherence of some cells or groups of cells with the other cells. And when those group of cells that are independent, are making themselves independent of the others, which is deadly for the whole system, when those only replicate themselves, then we have the known phenomenon, that's cancer. So coherence is fundamental for health, fundamental for the universe, fundamental for being here. And if there is a purpose, which we can discuss more in depth, if there is a purpose for our being here, that purpose certainly has to do with the fact that over time, we're becoming more and more coherent within us and with our world. When we don't do that, then we are sick. When we don't become coherent with the others around us, then we are a cancer in the biosphere. It's not that we can't do the opposite, but when we do the opposite, we go against the trend that governs the universe.
Join our subscriber section today. Click on the subscribe tab on unknowncountry.com to place your order.
I've been a subscriber to Unknown Country from almost the beginning. I get information there I can get nowhere else on the web.
This is Whitley Strieber. Go to Unknown Country and click on the subscribe tab. Join us. You owe it to yourself.
Well, you know, in Roy Ferdan's book, Physics from Fisher Information, he offers the thought that the Big Bang occurred out of a single, as he puts it, single primordial quest for knowledge. And I wonder if that might not be the direction of the universe. And I think that it certainly a lot of what is said in your book by the various scientists whose work you have collected would suggest that. So could you speak to that?
Well, where do we situate knowledge? Apparently what you are citing this quote is suggests that the quest for knowledge was prior to the process itself.
Or maybe simultaneous.
Or simultaneous. But it could also be that the quest for knowledge is something that is generated or that is manifested in the process of evolution. Certainly, the mystery is there. Why the Big Bang? Why did everything that exists now come to existence, come to being at that time? And as it comes to being, as it exists, as it evolves, it is capable of decoding, because it's more and more capable, become more and more coherent. It's capable of decoding what is around it, and ultimately decoding, in overall fashion, the whole universe. We are part of it. We are moving toward a super coherent universe. And that is a direction that certainly we need to recognize. Everything that we do, if it's healthy, if it's normal, it's getting more and more connected. It's toward interaction, in-phase interaction, you might say, the resonance between these clusters of vibrations. All these terms, I'll tell you one thing. Everything moves to become more and more one. Well, that's one of the oldest insights in the wisdom traditions of humanity. And it seems to be borne out by what we observe in physics, in biology, in the cognitive sciences. If something is healthy, if it's normal, it connects in phase, and it moves jointly together. The opposite means disease, means ill health, means something negative, breaking down. And now we are faced, of course, with the great question, how can we maintain and reestablish our coherence in the world, not to become extinct in this tremendously complex, super coherent drive toward connection, toward oneness? How can we do that? But certainly the fact is that this is the challenge. This is what is before us.
In the early part of the middle 20th century, as you point out, Sir Arthur Eddington and Paul Dirac noted the curiousness, I would say, of the coincidences concerning the parameters of the universe. And as you point out, the ratio of the electric force, the gravitational force, and an enormous number, but still, there seems to be some kind of direction there. It's as if it was any other way, the universe wouldn't work. And there's a whole long list of phenomena that are like this and structures that are like this. So my question then is, and this gets to sort of the primal creator idea, what do you think it is? What is this intelligence that seems to have made this thing, almost constructed it out of its own mind in some way? And I'll ask the next question. I'll just ask that one. I've got another question after that, but I'll ask that one first.
Well, what it is in itself, we don't know, and we probably can't know. We can only know whatever intelligence there is in the universe by how it works, by how it's manifested. And the manifestation is a non-accidental search for or drive toward, as you like, connection, coherence, interaction, joint evolution or co-evolution. These are all elements that appear in the universe. You know, one of the latest observations, it's not in the book, in this book yet, because I just came across this very recently, is they find that evolution in the sense of creating complex and coherent systems was not a product of living organisms, because it started before there would have been any living organisms. It solves the big problem that has plagued biologists and cognitive scientists for so many years. If you need DNA to create a living system, and if you also need the living system to create the DNA, how could this process get going? It's a chicken and an egg. You need one of them to be given. And now it appears that the drive which the great French philosopher Henri Bergson called élan vital, the vital drive. That is present. That was present before DNA, before life would have been present, because they are organic molecules coming to life. You find organic complex molecules, the basic elements of life in the interstellar space. They are present even around active superhot stars. Seem to be completely impossible according to the classical ideas of physics and biology. But you find them now that you have powerful telescopes and means of analysis. We find these complex organic molecules. Life.
I think you and I read the same paper. I just read that paper too.
Well, yeah, it's an astounding fact, and it is something that confirms the idea that there is an élan vital, there is a movement, a drive, a direction in the universe that is toward build-up, that toward creating these coherent complex systems that we call living systems, and then conscious systems. Probably life and consciousness are part of the same overall trend. They emerge at different points in its evolution, in the evolution of the cosmos, but they do emerge, and we are not by accident conscious. Not by accident alive, we are manifesting the drive that is responsible for the whole universe being something rather than nothing.
The most fundamental of all questions, why is there something rather than nothing? But I want to change our direction a little bit right now. In Chapter 6 of the book, Maria Seiji discusses the goals of contemporary social change in the context of what we've been talking about. And she mentions supercoherence, which I thought was a very important essay in a world which is struggling so much with negative and entropic social changes. Could you talk about supercoherence and its social implications?
Well, I think it's so important that I have suggested for my colleagues of the Club of Budapest that there are now in 24 countries, the Clubs of Budapest, and suggested that they should make this a key element of their striving, of their objectives, of their activities for creating a better world. I'm simply suggesting that we can distinguish. This is all arbitrary distinctions, of course. But we need to get a better hold of this phenomenon. Otherwise, you can just say everything is either coherent or not. But we can say that there is such a thing as a coherence that's internal to the system and a coherence that is external. Coherence within a system and coherence between and among systems. Now, this within coherence, I call the internal, intrinsic coherence, and the coherence between systems, extrinsic coherence. Intrinsic coherence means that all the cells, all the organs, all the elements of our body are connected and they are jointly striving for a common end. They are aligned jointly to maintain the organism in the living state. Extrinsic coherence means that this organism is so related to its environment that it can obtain the energies, the resources, whatever resources it needs, the chemical, biological, physical resources, also social and cognitive resources, so that it can live, it can survive, and can even evolve. When an organism, a system, is coherent both internally and externally, then we can call it supercoherent. Now, all forms of life that have survived all these changes, all the constant turmoil that is in the biosphere, and maintain their coherence and can even increase their coherence, all these organisms, all these species are moving toward the highest state, which would be supercoherence. Coherence within themselves, coherence with the others. They are holons. You know, the great novelist, end of last century, Arthur Koestler, also born in Hungary like I was, he said that you can look at the whole world as a set of holons, holons. And their holons are Janus-faced entities. They have two faces. Facing inwards, they are holes. Facing outwards, they are parts. But they are parts of larger holes. So there's a sequence of holes within holons, within holons, within holons. And if this sequence is finely tuned so that every part of it interacts with every other part and maintains this order, maintains their coherence together, then we can talk about supercoherence. If you ask what is wrong with the world today, and at bottom you are saying it is not sufficiently coherent. It is becoming incoherent. And why is that? And also in general terms, you can give an answer. We can say because we have this curious freedom. We always talk about the positive element of freedom, of being able to choose. Surely, that is an element. But when we are able to choose, that means that we can also make mistakes. And a system that is not as free as we are, with our mind, with our consciousness, doesn't really make mistakes. If it isn't aligned with the world around it, if it isn't aligned within itself, it breaks down. It disappears. It's then replaced by this constant selection, natural selection in biology, cultural selection, and so on. And then it's replaced by more coherent systems. But we have this freedom to choose badly, to make wrong decisions. And therefore, we can choose to be less than optimally coherent. When we have conflicts in the world, when we have wars, when we kill each other, when we spoil our environment, when we hurt each other and consider that we are us and others are enemies, they're others and not us, we are all making wrong choices based on wrong concepts. Because ultimately, there are no others. We ourselves are part of a larger whole. Which whole of these holons do you choose? The individual whole or the larger whole? What is good for the individual whole in the short term may not be good for the larger whole. That means what's good for the individual is not automatically good in the long term for the world around it. Some 50 years ago, the then president of General Motors said that what is good for General Motors is good for the world. Well, it sounded nice, but it turned out not to be true, because what is good for one company now, here and now, is not necessarily good for the environment, good for the competition, good for human beings and others. On the other hand, what is good for the largest whole on, the system of life on the planet, is necessarily good for all its elements, because we cannot live, we cannot survive, we cannot evolve except in connection, in co-evolution with each other. Therefore, we have to look at this largest whole. It's not a question of just us, just we. We come first and we are the only ones. We are part. We are a part, and what comes first is the good, the survivability, is the evolution, the development of the whole system. In this case, is the system of life on the planet, the biosphere. Possibly the biosphere is also a part of a larger system, the highest connection, the highest highest larger unit that science fiction writers talk about. The word escapes me now, but about an imperium that is made up of all biospheres in this part of the galaxy. That may or may not be. But what we know at this point, that on this Earth, on this planet, the system of life is the key, is the signal, is the measure for good and bad, for progress and regress. What is healthy, what is progressive, is what is a positive element of the viability of the evolution of the system of life. And the opposite is the negative, is the bad. And this, I think, is well worth keeping in mind, because we have so many choices to make. Do we promote just our good here and now, or do we look also for a larger good? I think it's very dangerous to what is known in science to sub-optimize, to only optimize our own good. and the present time, because the whole system might then go down the drain. It might become extinct. The whole system might die out. Not impossible. It can be done. Many great extinctions have happened on this planet. They could happen again. But now we are a multi force. We can either maintain this planet in working order, or we can become a kind of a cancer that disrupts the coherence and that destroys itself by destroying the others.
The founding document of the Club of Budapest, which you drafted along with the Dalai Lama, starts, in most parts of the world, the real potential of human beings is sadly underdeveloped. The way children are raised depresses their faculties for learning and creativity. And then it goes on in the same vein. And I think that it also mentions that stability is an illusion. And I wondered, as you were talking just before, that was drafted years ago. Where are we now? Because I see a move toward incoherence in this, both in our environmental systems and in our societies, paralleling them. And let me explain exactly what I mean. Remember the idea of the Arab Spring that came along some years ago? What happened was a drought in the Ukraine and Russia caused them to cut off sales of wheat to the Middle East, with the result that prices went up tremendously, and people were absolutely furious. This caused the overthrow of the old dictatorships, but it has been followed by an outbreak of chaos that goes on to this day, and is, in fact, seems to be intensifying as these endless wars, such as the one that's developed in Yemen between the Saudis and Iran, and the one in Syria, of course, which seem to be just unstoppable. And that kind of permanent chaos remains until finally the system is simply over. And I see that the spread of that kind of chaos throughout the world, all emerging essentially out of environmental change, leads where? I mean, it leads to extinction, obviously. But what can we do now? But for example, with regard to children, this is such a big problem. So many children grow up with so little education. How can we be proactive?
Well, these are the $64 billion questions, obviously. It comes down to the bottom question. How do we see ourselves and the world? Who are we really? How do we see that? How do we conceive of our role, of our purpose, of the meaning of our existence? Two big questions, and these are questions that philosophers have asked. And people ask them when they have nothing else to do. They're nice to sit by a fireside every once in a while and chat about these things. But they are very, very practical questions, because unlike in previous times, we have become so powerful that our decisions, our wrong decisions, can destroy us and the world around us. We have become so dependent on each other that is trying to outcompete, trying to come over and gain benefits at the expense of others. It's playing these negative or zero-sum games. It's either your game is my loss is your game. Doing this kind of thing ultimately will end in decohering the system, making it incoherent. So these are sort of big words, but us lying behind them is this recognition that what we do to others, we do to ourselves. Our fate and their fate is one. Now, children understand this very well. Usually children, before you start educating them, saying, this is my country, that's your country, these are foreigners, and this is my company, these are competing companies, and so on, before you start breaking apart the unity of things, children grow up naturally in seeking the unity, because every living species is oriented toward, by evolutionary imperatives, is oriented toward seeking the oneness with the others. It's there in us. We educate ourselves out of it. We have got off on the wrong foot in the first and second industrial revolutions, especially since we have adopted this reductionist, mechanistic, separatist paradigm that Einstein says is just an optical illusion, because ultimately under it all, we are one. We appear to be separate. When we adopted that I live in a world where I can do what I want as long as I don't go contrary to the laws of nature, because those are more powerful than I am, as long as we work within the laws of nature, I am free to do what I want. And this was behind the neoliberal ideology of management systems, Samuelson and others, claiming no other responsibility for a manager than just to make money by competing, by winning. And the same thing for generals in military forces. Win, be stronger than the others. This old Darwinian tenet is a deadly one. It no longer works. It never worked, because now we recognize in biology that the key element in nature, in for survival, is not competition, even though there are elements of competition, obviously. And the key element is cooperation, finding a way to work with others in your environment. If we could recognize this as basis for life, then we would change the way we behave. We don't want to inflict harm, certainly not inflict harm when that harm reaches us, then we inflict it on us. And that's what we are doing, unfortunately, now, by trying to win over others, outcompete others, subjugate others, whether in economic, managerial, financial terms, or actually power terms. By doing that, we are harming this coherence, which we need in the inner world. So it starts from the bottom up. It starts from how you look at yourself. These are paradigms. You know, this is the term I like to use, because it actually summarizes how scientists look at the world when they make an experiment, when they make an observation. There is nothing like what is known as an immaculate perception. You know, immaculate perception would be when you just see things the way they are. You never see things the way they are. You see them in the context of what you believe they are. And our beliefs out of the world, that they are, this world is a mechanism where every part is exchangeable, interchangeable, where everybody can do what they want as long as I said, don't go against the laws of nature. If that is true, then we are gradually taking apart the coherence that has come about by instinct, by intuition in this world. We are acting in the wrong way, with a wrong consciousness, acting on the basis of a wrong paradigm. This paradigm doesn't work anymore in the sciences, the mechanistic separatist paradigm. In quantum science, it doesn't work. We know that everything you do to one particle, also you also do another, especially if they ever started or entered the same quantum state. But these are technical elements that show that in nature, there is no separateness. Separateness is, as Einstein said, an optical illusion. So this is what the lesson in front of us, to recognize who we are, what the world around us is, and nothing, no teachings, no strategies that don't recognize this will work. Ultimately, we must know that the current seeking of love, of coherence, of oneness, is a healthy sign, is a sign of a culture that's awakening to what it really needs to be one. No longer purely poetic terms. These are very practical terms. If we can act on them, we will make it. If we don't, we can destroy ourselves, destroy our environment, and destroy the planet.
Erwin Laszlo, The Intelligence of the Cosmos. Why are we here? New answers from the frontiers of science, with a foreword by Jane Goodall and a number of essays from distinguished thinkers, scientists, and philosophers. Erwin, thank you so much for being with us on Dreamland. It has been a true pleasure to have you on the show, and a great honor. So thank you.
Well, Whitley, it's been my pleasure. You're asking the real questions, the important questions, not knowing that they're not simple to answer, but you dare to answer. And I dare to provide the suggest an answer because I know that I'm reaching sympathetic ears, you and your viewers, your listeners. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, I'm a thinker, and my listeners are too. So, and we've been together many years, most of us, listening to this show and making the show. Thank you so much again for being with us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host, and I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander. Thank you for listening.